morning. Let's turn in our Bibles to the book of Isaiah, chapter 60. In the bulletin, it actually says chapter 6. I'm hoping it should be chapter 60. That's what I prepared. Actually, I'm confident it is. It's on page 524 in the church Bibles. And we're going to be looking at the first three verses. I'll just read those now. Arise, shine, for your light has come, and the glory of the Lord rises upon you. See, darkness covers the earth, and thick darkness is over the peoples. But the Lord rises upon you, and his glory appears over you. Nations will come to your light, and kings to the brightness of your dawn. In 1969, when I was about the age of some of those kids that just went out, Buzz Aldrin and Neil Armstrong left an instrument on the moon. And it's actually the only instrument that's still there. It's a working experiment that's still in use. It's called the Lunar Laser Ranging Reflector Array. What it's used for is they can fire a laser from Earth up and bounce it off there, and then the light comes back. And they measure how long it takes, and because they know the speed of light, they can measure distances, and it's quite accurate. There's actually now four different similar devices on the moon that are used in the same way, and it takes about 2.5 seconds for a beam of light to go up there and be reflected back, and the accuracy is incredible. So if you imagine measuring a distance from here to Tehran, if you could measure that to an accuracy of 0.25 millimeter, that's the sort of accuracy that they're working with. So it's incredibly precise stuff. And so that's how light is used today. Light's used in many different ways. It's used in measuring. It's used in telecommunications through fiber optics, in lasers. They can cut sort of metal and things like that, and then they can be very precise, and they can use it in sort of very fine surgery. And on a very more fundamental level, light provides fuel for this planet directly with the heat of the sun, but also empowering the plants that feed us through photosynthesis. And when the people that Isaiah was speaking to heard them talking about light, they understood it fantastically. While they didn't have lasers and things like that, they used the phases of the moon in their agriculture and things like that. And so they understood it quite well. And actually, towards the end of the chapter, it goes on in verse 19. It says, "The sun will no longer be your light by day, nor will the brightness of the moon shine on you. For the Lord will be your everlasting light, and God will be your glory. The sun, your sun will never set again, and your moon will wane no more. The Lord will be your everlasting light, and your days of sorrow will end." And so that was a bit of clarification to what it's talking about at the beginning of the chapter when it says your light has come. That this is something different, this is something special that is being referred to when it says your light has come. So we're going to look at a couple of different things here. We're going to look at what it meant to the people that Isaiah was speaking to, and also what it means to us when we see the different phrases, your light has come, the darkness covers, and his glory appears. So those are the sort of the three different points we're going to be looking at, and we're going to look at how that applies to the people that Isaiah was speaking to, but also how, more importantly, how it applies to us today. So the first point, your light has come. The people of Israel, they remembered the story of being led out of Egypt. They were led out of Egypt through the wilderness by a pillar of fire and cloud. And the audience was well familiar with this story. They understood that this was something different. It wasn't like the sun, it wasn't like the moon, it was a supernatural thing, it was something that only God could do when he led them through the wilderness following this pillar of light and fire. And they knew it because they celebrated the Passover feast every year. In the same way that we celebrate Christmas every year, and so we understand the different ideas in the Christmas story. So if someone says manger, then even if it's you're not talking to a Christian person, they will understand the idea that that word has a lot of connotations with Christmas. So the people then, when they were thinking about light, they might have thought about this light that led them through the wilderness, their ancestors through the wilderness. And it was they understood that it was a supernatural thing. And it led them despite themselves. So they often grumbled, they complained, and yet even though there were problems, he took care of them. In Nehemiah chapter 9 it says, because of your great compassion, you did not abandon them, the people of Israel, in the wilderness. By day, a pillar of cloud did not fail to guide them on their path, nor the pillar of fire by night to shine on the way they were to take. You gave your good spirit to instruct them. You did not withhold your manna from their mouths, and you gave them water for thirst. For 40 years you sustained them in the wilderness. They lacked nothing. Their clothes did not wear out, nor did their feet become swollen. So when Isaiah said, your light has come, these sort of thoughts about this light that led them would have been in their mind. Now, much, much later, we can see this differently. We can see this with the whole of the Bible. And we can see that this is also talking about the coming of Christ. And so if we look in John chapter 1, we can read on page 748, it says, in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. He was with God in the beginning. Through him all things were made. Without him nothing was made that has been made. In him was life, and that light was the light of men. And the light shines in the darkness, but the darkness has not understood it. And it goes on, it says, there was a man who was sent from God, his name was John. He came as a witness to testify concerning that light, so that through him all men might believe. He himself was not the light, he only came as a witness to the light. The true light that gives light to every man was coming into the world. And so that's what we see, that we can see Christ himself as the light. And Jesus later on refers to himself as the light of the world. Whoever follows me will never walk in darkness, but will have the light of life. We see that light is often seen in contrast. So it's light versus darkness. And that's how it's used in the Isaiah passage. Arise, your light has come. The glory of the Lord rises upon you. See, darkness covers the earth, and thick darkness over its people. But the Lord rises upon you, and his glory appears over you. So we've seen light and how it was used to lead the people, and that Jesus is the light. But let's see how darkness was seen by the people of Isaiah's time and how we should see it. So the phrase darkness covering the earth would have resonated with Isaiah's audience. It would have reminded them of Genesis, where it says, in the beginning, God created the heavens and earth, and now the earth was formless and empty, and darkness was over the surface of the deep, and the Spirit of God was hovering over the water. So it would have reminded them of the creation story. But I think they would have had other thoughts as well. It puts us in mind of what happened just before the time that the people of Israel were leaving the land of Egypt. Moses was sent before Pharaoh, the king of Egypt, and he was to tell him that to let the people go, to let these enslaved people go from this land. And God sent progressively harsher plagues to convince the Egyptians to allow the people to go from their bondage. And the ninth plague caused chaos in the land. In Exodus 10, it says, then the Lord said to Moses, stretch out your hand towards the sky so that darkness spreads over Egypt, darkness that can be felt. So Moses stretched out his hand towards the sky, and total darkness covered all Egypt for 3 days. No one could see anyone else or move about for 3 days, yet all the Israelites had light in the places where they lived. And so we have this contrast between the utter darkness for the stubborn Egyptians and light for God's special people. There was only one more plague that followed that, and that was judgment of death upon the firstborn sons all across Egypt. And this is what caused the Egyptians to finally let God's people go. For us, with hindsight again, we can see where the darkness and utter darkness once again occurs. In the New Testament, we see it when Christ is crucified and dying. And it helps us to remember, thinking about this, that his death was at the same time that the nation was celebrating Passover. And so God has orchestrated this so that the one points to the other. Luke 23 tells us, let's have a look there. The end of Luke 23. And now it was about the sixth hour, and darkness came over the whole land until the ninth hour, for the sun stopped shining, and the curtain of the temple was torn in two. Jesus called out with a loud voice, "Father, into your hands I commit my spirit." And with this, he breathed his last. The centurion, seeing what had happened, praised God and said, "Surely this was a righteous man." When all the people who had gathered to witness the sight saw what had taken place, they beat their breasts and went away. So we see the strong parallels between the two narratives. In Egypt, there were 3 days of unnatural darkness covering the land before the final plague. And at the cross, we see 3 hours of unnatural darkness covering the land before God's only Son is killed on the cross as a sacrifice to pay for the sins of the world. So the Passover story is providing an arrow pointing to the cross for us. So having seen both the ideas of light and darkness, we need to understand what ties them together. Are the ideas of light and darkness equal? There's the Chinese philosophy of yin and yang, and they think of light and dark as equal forces. The Christian idea is very different. The Christian idea, it's not the same. There's no equality between the light and darkness. Christ has won the race even before it started. Death has been defeated. Satan is not equal in power to Christ. Satan is a defeated foe. And we see that as we look at what the light is all about. So in Isaiah again, it says, "Arise, shine, your light has come. The glory of the Lord rises upon you. See, darkness covers the earth and thick darkness over the people, but the Lord rises upon you and his glory appears over you. Nations will come to your light and kings to the brightness of your dawn." So how do the people of Isaiah see God's glory? Well, we see that when they, thinking back to the Exodus story, when they left, they didn't just stop being slaves. They didn't leave empty-handed. They left with the plunder of Egypt. In Exodus 11, it says, "Now the Lord had said to Moses, 'I will bring one more plague to Pharaoh and on Egypt, and after that he will let you go from here. And when he does, he will drive you out completely. Tell the people, the men and the women alike, are to ask their neighbors for articles of silver and gold.' The Lord had made the Egyptians favorably disposed towards the people, and Moses himself was highly regarded in Egypt by Pharaoh's officials and people." So they didn't leave empty-handed. I've been sort of recently studying about and learning about the American Civil War, what caused it, what the major characters were, and things like that in the battles. And it was primarily, obviously, left by caused by the North learning the horrors of what it meant to live as a slave in the southern states of America. And there was one book that really educated people in this more than any other, and it was called Uncle Tom's Cabin. I've read it recently, and it is quite sort of heartbreaking to read. When Abraham Lincoln, the American president, met the author, Harriet Beecher Stowe, it said that he greeted her by saying, "So you're the little woman who wrote the book that started this great war." And when you read it, you can understand that. And one of the things that you understand in studying about this, that when people escaped slavery, although they were free, it was actually not necessarily always easy. It wasn't going to be easy because they left empty-handed. They often only left with the clothes on their back. They had no food. They had no place to live. They weren't welcome. This is not how God rescued his people. When they left their enslavement, they left with the gold of Egypt. So it was sort of quite a glorious departure. Not only were they free, but they had this wealth that was given to them by the people of Egypt. But we see that there are other ways that they would have understood glory. So after this, the people of Egypt, the people of Israel, when they were wandering in the desert, they used that gold. We see that they had sent men to spy out the land that they were to take over. And 10 of the 12 men gave reports that doubted that God would be able to conquer this land. And as a result of that, the people were punished. They ended up wandering in the desert. And Moses went up on the mountain to speak to God. The people, while he was there, the people rebelled and they ignored the history that they had had of God rescuing them. And while Moses was on the mountain, they took that gold and they made themselves an idol, a calf of gold. And when Moses came down, there was punishment for the people that had done this. And then Moses went back up on the mountain and he talked to God. And when he was talking to God, there was this conversation. And it's in Exodus 34. Yes. The Lord passed before him and said, the Lord, a God merciful and gracious, slow to anger and abounding in steadfast love and faithfulness, keeping steadfast love for thousands, forgiving iniquity and transgression and sin, but who will by no means clear the guilty, visiting the iniquity of the fathers on the children and the children's children to the third and fourth generation. Moses quickly bowed his head towards the earth and worshipped, and he said, if now I have found favor in your sight, O Lord, please let the Lord go in the midst of us, for it is a stiff-necked people. Pardon our iniquity and our sin, and take us for your inheritance. And then in the next verse 10, God replies, behold, I am making a covenant. Before all your people, I will do marvels, such as not been created in all the earth or in any nation. And all the people among whom you are shall see the work of the Lord, for it is an awesome thing that I will do for you. So despite their grumbling, despite their production of a golden calf and worshiping it, despite their rebellion, their loving God had a glorious plan for them. So how do we see God's glory 2,000 years later? Well, we see it in his love for the people of Israel. We can see their rebellion, even though we quite often don't see the rebellion in our own lives. In the New Testament, Apostle Paul said in 2 Corinthians 2, said, for God, who said, let light shine out of darkness, has shone in our hearts to give the light of the knowledge of the glory of God in the face of Jesus Christ. So Paul's referring to the creation narrative, let light shine out of darkness, but he's also using it to explain how God's glory is seen in Christ, and the contrast of light out of darkness is demonstrated in Christ's victory over sin and death at the cross. And in our passage in Isaiah, it finishes in verse 3, which says, nations will come to your light and the kings to the brightness of your dawn. So God's opened up this offer of victory over death, not just to his chosen people in the Old Testament, but to all nations all across the earth. It's no longer restricted to just this one family group, but to everyone. And we see that as we read this morning in John 3:16, for God so loved the world, the whole world. We know that there are problems and struggles on this earth and in our lives. When we read about Christ's coming glory, we know that while this prophecy has been fulfilled, by Christ's birth, his sinless death, his sinless life, death, and resurrection, we also know that it's not been completely fulfilled when we read this prophecy in Isaiah. At the end of the chapter, as I read earlier, it says, "The sun will no more be your light by day, nor will the brightness of the moon shine on you, for the Lord will be your everlasting light, and your God will be your glory. Your sun will never set again, and your moon will wane no more, and the Lord will be your everlasting light, for your days of glory, of sorrow will end." So this final prophecy, will be finally fulfilled when Christ returns. In that time, there'll be no more need for the sun, because God will be our glory. His light will be our glory, and it'll replace the need for the sun. And there will be no more sorrow. So it's a fantastic promise. So in conclusion, if we've seen that light and darkness and glory, if we've seen what these mean in the passage, what does it mean to you and me? Is this just an intellectual exercise? Does it affect my life? Does it affect what I do, what I think, how my conversations are conducted? Well, I think there's two different types of people. There's those who have already said, yes, I want Christ to rule over my life. And there's also people who think, actually, I don't need God. I don't need him for anything. And so I think we can look at this passage with those two different types of people in mind. So if you're someone who is submitted to Christ as a ruler of your life, a few thoughts and questions. Does my life properly reflect the light and glory of Christ in all areas of my life, all the areas of my life? Or do I keep one area back? Do I think, okay, I'll do this and this and this, but this one area, I'm just going to do my own thing. Or maybe I hold on to worries in one particular part of my life. So maybe there's one part of my life that I find much harder to surrender than the others. And so those are thoughts that we can think about. But we're called to reflect the light of Christ. In the same way that the moon reflects the light of the sun, the moon is a major, major light in the darkness of this world, but it has no power of its own. We're called to be the lights of Christ to our families, to our workmates, to our friends, reflecting God's love into their lives. But what if you're someone who isn't sure about this Christianity business? Then I think these verses also pose some questions to you. If what's said in this book is true, that the battle between light and darkness is unequal, then Christ has won. And that means that we need to examine our lives and think, what do I do in response to that? And so we need to submit to him and confess that we're not able to save ourselves. Quite often it's easy to think that there's some sort of divine scales, that if I do good things, then God has to see me as a good person and accept me. But if we're depending on what we're able to accomplish in our own self, to merit in our own goodness, we need to understand that the Almighty, perfect, sinless God sees this how it really is. He sees our hearts. A few chapters later, the prophet Isaiah says, all our righteous acts are like filthy rags. And so that's how God sees our best things. And that's the whole reason that Jesus came. Because the best that we can do is like filthy rags. God, if we accept Jesus as our Savior, God sees Jesus' righteousness instead of our attempts at righteousness. And so, we read earlier in John 3, verse 19, "This is the verdict. Light has come into the world, but men love darkness instead of light because their deeds were evil. Everyone who does evil hates the light and will not come into the light for fear that his deeds will be exposed. But whoever lives by the truth comes into the light so that it may be seen plainly that what he has done has been done through God. So we can be thankful for that. Let's bow in prayer. Dear Lord, thank you that you are the light. Thank you that you have this great love for us beyond our understanding. I pray that you might work in hearts today.